Does the marketplace encourage narcissism? Author Paul Roberts says yes. In his new book, Roberts looks at how we cope with a socioeconomic system that's almost too good at giving us what we want. My colleague Ross Reynolds asked Roberts how the marketplace, appealing more directly to individuals as opposed to society as a whole, encourages narcissism.
We call this the personalization of the economy, and certainly there are massive benefits. You know, in the near future, we may say things like, you know, medicine that's customized to our DNA, you know, energy grids that know exactly how much you actually need at various points in the day and can price it accordingly. And the list goes on. The downside is that most of that great innovation is being used to give us personalization that is somewhat trivial. I mean, it's fun, but it's sort of distracting and trivial. I mean, how many times can we monitor our pulse or our caloric burn or how many steps we've taken? And you could argue that the more focused we are on those things, the less bandwidth we have for things outside of our sort of immediate experience. So there's that one issue. But I think the issue that you allude to is that by allowing people to sort of, you know, personalize their economic experience, we're no longer as reliant on the social networks that we once were. So an example, if we can just buy a meal completely made or have it delivered, you know, then we don't need to rely on the family. We don't have to sort of defer to our mom, who was traditionally the provider of food, who had the expertise and access to the kitchen, where many of us were forbidden. You know, traditionally, we don't have to sit at three family meals and thus get the socialization that came from that. So, you know, you get the benefits from the individual, but to the degree that the individual depends for his happiness and his sort of sustainability on a social network, this power to the individual, it comes with some costs.
So are we more self-centered than we were in the past?
That's certainly, you know, people would argue absolutely the case, that we've sort of developed a sort of a materialist-based narcissism, the sort of de facto narcissism, simply, you know, as a consequence of an economy that is so focused on the self and allows us to be so focused on ourselves. But I think that, you know, we could debate whether that's making narcissism go up, whether we're measuring the right thing. I mean, there's a fairly large academic debate going on about that very question. But certainly, you know, if you're looking at terms of social impacts, you could say, well, yes, politically we're more fragmented. You know, it's easier today to sort ourselves into a group of an enclave of like-minded political allies, where we'll hear essentially the views that we already espouse, and we won't be forced to confront opposing views, and therefore forced to at least assess and reassess our own. So the sort of the moderating force that comes from a diverse society and those chance encounters, that moderating force is diminished. And I think you're seeing the result of that in the paralysis in Washington, for sure.
As I was reading your book, I was thinking of the current standoff between Hachette Publishing and Amazon. And roughly speaking, Amazon says they want to drive a harder bargain with publishers to lower the price for us so that we'll be able to get these things more easily and less expensively. Hachette and its author supporters say, no, this is an important factor in our cultural society. By the way, are you a Hachette author?
No.
Okay. So is that kind of part of what you're talking about when we've got these two sides lining up, one that says it's serving us better, Amazon, the other that it's serving the culture better, Hachette and its authors?
It's exactly, and it really points up the paradox, because on the one hand, you and I have benefited tremendously from cheaper books. And further, I know a lot of authors who wouldn't have been able to break into publishing at all. The barriers to entry are so high, but because of Amazon's new model, you know, you can basically self-publish through Amazon. They'll split the proceeds with you 50-50, or at least I don't know what it is now, but it's quite generous. And suddenly you're published. And if you play your cards right, if you market well and have a good social media setup, you can actually make a living. So that's been a fantastic outcome of this sort of model. The downside is that it's really hurt traditional publishing. And you could say, well, they were all dinosaurs. But I mean, look at another example of that. An analogy would be, you know, Walmart. You know, Walmart drove down prices. It also forced other competitors to drive down prices. So it helped drive down the price of goods. But that was a bargain, really, because it was also indirectly or directly destroying a lot of the domestic industry that had provided the jobs and the medium, you know, the mid-level wages that had allowed us to buy those more expensive goods. So it's sort of like they said, all right, we're going to wipe out the one of the engines of American prosperity, but don't worry, we're going to make your food cheaper. You know, and that's been sort of the understanding. Amazon is simply the latest sort of iteration of that.
I'm talking to Paul Roberts about his book, The Impulse Society, and kind of the core idea here is that we have a socioeconomic system that's almost too good at giving us what we want. Can we stipulate that this is a first world problem? Are people in developing nations who are having a hard time getting by really so well served by their socioeconomic systems?
Oh, I mean, that's an important point. It is a first world problem, and further, it's a first world problem that that draws distinctions between what part of the first world you're looking at. You know, clearly there are many people in this country who don't feel like they can avail themselves of the economic personalization. You know, who don't have the time or the money to have the app that measures their heartbeat every morning. So that's absolutely the case. But it's very closely related because a lot of the problems that the economy is having in terms of recovering, you know, the slowness of the recovery and generally the flattening of wages that we've had over the last 30 years is tightly related to this newer economic model, which is all about driving down costs regardless and pushing the social impacts onto somebody else. So it's very closely related. I think that, you know, if you looked at, you know, someone who's too poor to afford many of these things, they are still hyper aware that those things are out there. You know, whether they're in another country looking in or in our own country looking in, you know, that's very much part of the culture. Here's the thing you don't have. And I think that the extra wrinkle, and there are many wrinkles here, is that a lot of what we can no longer afford materially, like we can no longer afford a big house or a big car, the digital world offers sort of a virtual version of, you know, so that we can occupy ourselves with as much delight, at least, you know, in the short term, as the elite could have a century ago. You know, so it's as if there's been this grand bargain, this a huge exchange was made, and many of us made it without being fully aware of it, was we're going to take away traditional pathways to prosperity and economic security, but we're going to give you a way to sort of distract yourself as so that you don't realize that that's happened.
As you've thought about this in writing this book, has it changed the way you live your life, Paul Roberts?
Well, yeah, I suppose it's made me realize, first of all, how weak I am in many respects. You know, I've spent a lot of time talking with the scientists who study how we make decisions and how impulsive we are and how short-term we are in our outlook, and it's really depressing. You know, to think that we've built this massive civilization that's so complicated and sophisticated and has so many things that took a long time to make. So in other words, they are implicit in those things is this sort of long-term view. And yet the individuals that are running around in that system, you know, sometimes we're working for the weekend. You know?
Yeah. Like that makes me think that cognitively maybe we can never evolve beyond an impulse society.
Well, I think that you need to look to our history, and I think that would offer a counterexample, you know, because, I mean, that's been the story of civilization, was finding ways to persuade or coerce individuals to stop being so dang short-term and to stop being so self-serving. You know, spend a little time looking beyond tomorrow, think a little bit more about your neighbor, and we will compensate you with a socioeconomic system that gives you a better return than if you were just living in a cave in the woods. The problem there is that implicit in that bargain was this understanding that human beings, if you offered them a better way to get what they wanted, they would take it. I mean, we're optimal foragers. You know, if we can find a way to get more for less, we'll do it. And as the consumer economy began to offer these individual, you know, sort of capabilities, whether it's a car or canned food, your 401k, and you begin to feel as if you don't need society and you don't need to be patient, then you stop behaving those ways. I mean, it's really, it comes down to incentives. Ultimately, it needs to come from individuals who recognize, and whether it's at a gut level or intellectually, that the current system doesn't work, and further that their part in it is contributing.
Well, Paul, neither of us looked at our cell phones for this entire conversation, so I think we've taken an important first step here.
I'm so proud of us.
If you want to learn more about what Paul Roberts learned from writing The Impulse Society, you can catch him tomorrow night at Town Hall, Seattle. He spoke with Ross Reynolds. I'm Marcy Silman, and this is The Record.